This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. I hope everybody had a great week. Did you?
So far, so good.
Well, let's see what we can do to fix that. I'd like to ask everybody before I start this episode to take a second to hit the subscribe / follow button. And with that being said, I am ready to rock this episode out.
Let's do it.
Peter and Joan Porgo closed their blinds and pulled together the pleated bedroom curtains that covered the window of their master bedroom. The couple, they've been married for over 30 years. They prefer to sleep in the pitch dark and especially hated when the early morning sunlight crept in the room through the window when they were sleeping.
I'm the same way.
Me too. Peter and Joan shared a modest four-bedroom, two-story house on a tree-lined street in the village of Delmar, just outside of Albany, New York. The 2,200-square-foot home felt a bit more empty now that the couple's two adult sons, Jonathan and Chris, they no longer lived there. 23-year-old Jonathan was a naval officer stationed in South Carolina, and 21-year-old Chris lived in the University of Rochester campus, some 230 miles away. So now the couple had basically an empty nest. On that 14th night of November in 2004, before Peter went to bed, he turned on the security alarm from the keypad on the kitchen wall. The couple had purchased the security system 2 years earlier after a home invasion in the middle of the night. That was one of two burglaries they had experienced in the past 2 years. After letting Barrister, the family's Labrador retriever, outside to do his dog business, Peter and Joan shut off the TV, turned off the lights, and fell asleep sometime before midnight. Peter was a lawyer at the New York Court of Appeals, and he had been preparing all week for a trial he had the next morning. Before the sun rose, per his usual routine, Peter stumbled out of the king-size bed he shared with Joan, and he wandered towards the master bedroom, stumbling around a bit in the dark as his eyes adjusted. In the bathroom, he flicked the light switch on, and he lifted up the toilet seat to relieve himself. When he was done, he went over to the sink to wash up, inadvertently dropping some tissue on the floor. As he stood in front of the ceramic sink, the mirror attached to the wall above it reflected a ghastly scene, something straight out of a horror flick. But in Peter's morning stupor, he failed to notice anything wrong. Had he might still be alive today.
Damn.
After finishing in the bathroom, Peter ambled over to the bedroom closet and he grabbed a pair of black trousers off the hanger. From his dresser drawer, he pulled out a pair of white socks, and then he sat on the bed to put them on. Only a few feet from behind where Peter sat, partially hidden by a blanket, there was a 3-foot-long wooden axe covered with hair, blood, and human tissue. But Peter didn't notice. After getting dressed for work, Peter moseyed down the stairs, through the family room, and into the kitchen. The sun had yet to rise, and with the blinds and the curtains closed, there was no natural light to illuminate his way or to highlight the trail of blood that now covered the linoleum floor. In the kitchen, he flicked the light switch on, and he went about his normal routine, because Peter was a man of structure and routine. First, he made himself some breakfast, and he sat at the kitchen table, unbeknownst to Peter. He was sitting on a wooden chair that not only had blood on it, but droplets of blood underneath it on the floor. These drops of blood were surrounded by scattered, bloody footprints. After finishing breakfast, he put his dishes in the dishwasher and began packing a lunch to take to the office. He sat his black thermal lunchbox on the wooden kitchen table, and he made his way into the foyer to a file cabinet that held a lot of their family documents. As he's walking to the foyer, he's totally oblivious to the bright red, bloody handprint plastered on the wall. A brutal slaughter had occurred in the middle of the night at the Delmar house, but Peter hadn't noticed any of the clues. Had he might have been able to save himself from the imminent demise that awaited him. After thumbing through the file cabinet, Peter made his way into the kitchen, remembering that he had a cashier's check for his son Chris's parking tickets that he needed to mail out to the Saratoga Springs court. If he would have looked down as he crossed the tiled foyer floor and into the kitchen, he could have seen the telltale signs that someone severely injured had been stumbling around that area. But he didn't. He had no clue that there was a slaughter that had just happened. He trekked back through the bloody foyer and proceeded to open the front door to get the morning newspaper. Every morning, he liked to just take a few minutes to read the paper. He went outside into the brisk morning air and he picked up the paper off the front porch. But when he went to come back inside the house, he realized that the door had shut and locked behind him. The family always placed a single key with a string on it in the flower pot that was on their front porch just in case they ever got locked out. You know, like we all do or think we're real clever hiding it in the flower pot. Using that key, Peter unlocked the door and he headed towards the steps. But then something stopped him in his tracks. That morning, Peter failed to show up for the scheduled trial he had. This was a really big deal because you and I know, as lawyers, you do not miss a trial date.
That's a No. You better have a very good reason.
Very good. Or your ass will be handed to you on a platter by a judge. A colleague of his, court officer Michael Hart, he tried to reach Peter on the phone. He called a few times, but he got no response. And this gave him cause for concern because Peter was very dependable and he didn't miss work without calling in. After trying again and again and getting no answer, Michael decided Peter's absence was important enough that he make the 15-minute drive from the Albany courthouse to the Delmar residence to check on Peter. And it was about 11:30 in the morning by the time he arrived. The first thing Michael noticed was that one lone key with a string attached was still in the doorknob. Looking through the front window, Michael could see Peter's motionless body laying on the tile in the foyer and massive amounts of blood surrounding him. Michael immediately called for backup and he waited for police and EMT to arrive. First responders were beside themselves as they entered the house. Blood was immediately noticed on the floor of the entryway. To the right are stairs that lead to the second level, and at the base of those stairs was the dead body of Peter. Peter was lying on the landing to the stairway. His face was pointed up to the stairs, and his legs were dangling off the landing onto the floor. So he was actually on the stairs. His clothing was saturated in blood, and he had obviously suffered tremendous, catastrophic injuries. His once white socks were now red, drenched in his own blood. And it gets much worse. A more detailed examination of him noted that his lower jaw was missing.
What?
It appeared as if it had been chopped off.
Stop it.
Damn. His head had a chopping wound in it an inch deep that cracked his skull and penetrated his brain.
Oh my God.
The medical examiner concluded that Peter had sustained a total of 16 chopping wounds to his head, chest, and underneath both arms, plus on his hands.
Holy shit.
And the attack on Peter didn't commence after he got the newspaper from outside, but it had started hours earlier while he lay asleep in the middle of the night next to Joan.
So these injuries were all sustained before he got up?
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding you.
Wow. I am floored right now.
After being hit with an axe 16 times, Peter fell unconscious. But he later woke up, and that's when he went to the bathroom. While he was washing up in the sink in front of the mirror, he failed to realize he was missing his jaw and that his head was sliced open, among other injuries. As he got dressed, he put on a shirt, oblivious to the chop wounds under both of his arms and on his hands. He also walked downstairs, profusely bleeding from his head and chest, and that's where the trails of blood came from. The crime scene showed Peter walked all over that house in his blood. I mean, bloody footprints were everywhere, and you can see the pictures on our website. It's shocking. Yet he never noticed. In the kitchen, investigators found blood on the stove, blood on the countertop, on the dishwasher, on the light switch, and of course, all over the floor. There were bloody paper towels on the floor in the kitchen, which means that Peter either tried to clean something up or used it to maybe dry his hands and then put them on the kitchen floor. The particular brain injury that Peter sustained from the axe damaged his neocortex, which controls reasoning, but it left intact the underlying paleocortex, which guides second nature habits.
Oh.
In essence, Peter was on autopilot.
How did he eat his breakfast?
That I don't know. I just know he made a breakfast and he sat at the table.
Wow. This is crazy.
It is crazy. The dishwasher was still open, and on the top rack, on top of some dishes, was a $100 cashier check that Peter had gotten the day before for his son Chris's parking tickets, and it had bloody fingerprints on it. Somehow, Peter managed to make a breakfast and pack a lunch. It must have been that that was just so routine for Peter that he didn't even have to think about it. And I wonder if there was a little less damage to his neocortex and he had called 911 if he could have been saved, but I don't know. The crime scene was morbid. Blood could be found in every room in the house except for the son's rooms, Chris and John, and the second bathroom and the basement. And all the blood throughout the house was Peter's, except for some blood in the master bedroom. As investigators entered that room, they found the origin of where the crime started. And they also found 54-year-old Joan laying on the mattress, and that mattress was completely saturated with blood. She, too, had received chopping wounds from an axe to her face and head. Her left eye was missing. Her jaw was crushed and dislocated. She had several missing teeth, and her head was fractured in several spots from repeated blows. Those blows penetrated her skull deeply enough to expose her brain.
Oh my God.
She also had some chopping wounds to her chest, but despite all of these injuries, Joan was still alive and conscious.
What?
She is awake.
Holy shit.
Joan was able to follow the EMT's basic commands, such as keep your legs still and don't move your arms. But with a crushed and dislocated jaw, she wasn't able to verbally communicate what had transpired earlier that night. At the foot of the couple's bed, as I stated earlier, partially covered by a blanket, was a 3-foot-long wooden axe with a red cheek. I looked it up. I guess it's called cheek.
The blade?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I want to sound smart.
I know. I never knew that.
Right? You learn things. When you listen to Crimes and Consequences, you learn things. Blood spatter was on the walls above the bed, and there was a large saturation spot where Peter had slept. Me trying to describe it doesn't do it justice. When you see the pictures, you realize that Peter lost massive amounts of blood. And it was this loss of blood that actually killed him. Joan was rushed to the Albany Medical Center, where she underwent 12 hours of life-saving surgery. Due to her brain swelling, she was placed in a medically induced coma. The pathologist who had arrived on the scene, he got there about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He gave a really large time frame for Peter's death. He estimated, based on Peter's body temperature and other variables, that Peter died sometime between 1:30 and 6:30 in the morning, but probably closer to 6:30. He said he really just couldn't give with a reasonable degree of certainty the time of death. So I described what the scene was like inside the house. But before I tell you more about what the police found at the Porco residence, we're going to take a quick break. Another important thing that they found inside the house that I forgot to mention was that in the basement, where the main security panel was for the security system they had installed 2 years prior, that had been smashed with an axe to disarm it. And as I mentioned, the Porco family had been the victims of 2 previous home invasions. It was almost 2 years earlier to the day that someone broke into the Porco residence while Peter, Joan, and their son Chris were sleeping. Chris was home from college for the Thanksgiving break. And in the middle of the night, as they were all laying down, a burglar snuck in, and he or she ended up stealing Joan's work computer, which belonged to the Shelmont School District, along with a digital camera and one of Peter's laptops. Strange shoe prints led away from that window before disappearing into the driveway. Later, the missing camera was located in the front lawn. Apparently, whoever stole it must have dropped it when they were leaving. Whoever did this was never identified, and the crime went unsolved. Less than a year after that, on July 21st in 2003, at 7:15 a.m., Peter called the police to report another home invasion. Again, while Peter, Joan, and their son Chris, who was home from college for the summer, while they were sleeping, someone caught a screen in the first level, opened a window, and let themselves in. This time, the new laptop Peter got was again stolen. And they had the security alarm in place by the second home invasion, and I'm not sure if it wasn't on that night or for whatever reason, it didn't work. After the second home invasion, they installed sensor lights for the outside. But because they had their dog and they would let Barrister out, they often didn't put those lights on. 2 weeks prior to the murder, the motion sensor lights were on, and Joan spotted a shadowy figure in her driveway. This person was also never identified. So now I'm going to describe to you what police found on the outside of the house. Immediately, they noticed that the phone lines had been cut. In addition, a window screen on the first level had also been sliced, and the window itself was still open. So they figured the culprit must have climbed through the window. Someone clearly wanted this couple, who'd been married for 30 years, dead. But the question is who? So let's find out.
That is the question.
And I've got some answers for you. Police confirmed that Peter and Joan's oldest son, Jonathan, he's that Navy lieutenant I was telling you about, he was at the Nuclear Power Training Command in Charleston, South Carolina. His younger brother, Chris, had been living at the University of Rochester in the dorms, and that was some 230 miles away from the scene of the murder. And this is really kind of unfortunate. Chris found out that his parents were dead, by getting a phone call from a news reporter at his dorm.
Oh, man.
This reporter asked him if he had any comments regarding the brutal killing of his parents earlier that day.
That's shitty.
It is shitty, right? He immediately came back to Del Mar and ended up speaking with the police. This is really interesting because we're talking about potential suspects, right? Peter Porco had an uncle named Frank, and Frank worked as a captain for the Bonanno crime family in New York City. Frank Porco was serving 2 years in prison for loan sharking and extortion. And you know what his nickname was?
Oh no, what?
Frankie the Fireman.
Why?
Some people say because he liked to use an axe.
Uh-oh.
People speculated that perhaps Joan and Peter were attacked as a means of warning Frankie the Fireman not to squeal on anyone while he was behind bars. But that didn't really seem likely to the police because Frankie the Fireman hadn't seen Peter in almost 20 years. He was estranged. In addition, Frankie the Fireman was doing time precisely because he wouldn't squeal on any of his cohorts. He wouldn't do a deal with the police.
Snitches get stitches.
That's right. Yeah. And he didn't want any stitches. Mm-mm. Co-workers at the appellate court where Peter was employed, they informed police that there was a man whom Peter had been up against in a custody court case who openly stated that he would get revenge on Peter after losing custody of his children. However, this man was later identified and he had an ironclad alibi, so he was ruled out. As the police began looking into the facts of this case, a lead suspect quickly developed, and this came as a shock to both the family and to the community. It was almost 3 weeks before Joan was awakened from her coma. Besides her obvious physical injuries, which required extensive rehabilitation, Joan also suffered from retrograde amnesia and post-trauma amnesia. This means she couldn't remember anything about what happened during the crime or slightly before it. Upon regaining consciousness, she was surprised to learn that the police had a suspect, and it was all thanks to her. She had provided the identity of Peter's killer, but now had no memory of who did it.
Really? Damn.
While paramedics were working on Joan, who was laying bleeding in her bed, a detective named Detective Bodish had taken the steps to determine the names of the two Porco children, Jonathan and Chris. Detective Bodish asked Joan, while she was still laying in the bed and an IV was being put in her, if anybody in the family was responsible for the attack. And Joan shook her head up and down, like, yeah. When the detective asked if it was Jonathan, Joan shook her head side to side, suggesting a negative response. He then asked if it was Chris who did it, and Joan moved her head up and down and also moved her hand back and forth, pointing a finger upward. The same two questions were asked again regarding the son's involvement, and again, Joan indicated that Jonathan wasn't involved, but Chris was. And her reactions were confirmed by another EMT on the scene who verified what Detective Bodish saw. During Joan's recovery, she was adamant that her son Chris was not capable of such atrocious crimes. Just like, no.
Well, I'm sure she doesn't want to believe that her son did it.
Right.
I mean,
absolutely not.
It's heinous.
But she was so convinced of his innocence that she even allowed him to move back into the house with her.
What? Did she think the police were lying?
She thinks the police were just completely wrong. In fact, she found the police's pursuit of Chris to be really upsetting. Joan wrote a letter to the Times Union paper about how upset she was with the investigators focusing on Chris. In that letter, she stated, quote, I implore the Bethlehem police and the district attorney's office to leave my son alone and to search for Peter's real killer or killers so that he can rest in peace and my sons and I can live in safety, end quote. But police continued to investigate Chris, and a year after the murders, in December 2005, he was indicted by the grand jury for the murder of his father and the attempted murder of his mother. Police arrested him, and he was held on bond. But Jones scraped up the $250,000 needed for his release, and once again, he moved in with her. Regardless of what Joan felt in her heart, all the evidence police uncovered pointed to an inside job. Someone within the inner circle of the family had to be responsible, and it was most definitely Chris. Here's the evidence presented against him at trial. On the night of Peter's murder, the burglary alarm was smashed, right? We know it was smashed in the basement. But before it was smashed in the basement, it was deactivated by someone in the kitchen using the 4-digit master code. Only 6 people had that code. Peter, Joan, Jonathan, Chris, a neighbor, and another family relative. Whoever axed the main alarm system pad in the basement didn't realize that doing so wouldn't erase the previous records of all the alarm's activities.
Oh, man. Dumb.
In addition, the main alarm system pad was in the basement, and Chris's fingerprint was found on the basement door. Chris's defense tried to counter this by suggesting that maybe Peter had let the dog out at 2:14 a.m. and shut the alarm off and then forgot to turn it back on before he went to bed. But when you see the rest of the evidence, you'll know that's all bullshit. In addition, according to phone records, someone cut the phone lines outside to the landline at 4:59 a.m. And this timeline of the alarm being deactivated at 2:14 a.m. and the phone line being cut at 4:59 is really important because, contrary to Chris's alibi, in which he stated he slept all night on a couch in the lounge of his dorm, surveillance footage at the university shows Chris's yellow Jeep Wrangler leaving the parking lot at 10:30 p.m. At 10:45, a toll booth worker getting ready to end his shift remember seeing Chris's Jeep enter the highway that you would take to get to his parents' house. And the reason why this Jeep stood out to this worker was because he was a big fan of Jeeps. He had a Jeep, his wife had a Jeep, and Jeep lovers love Jeeps.
Right.
To get to Chris's parents' house, it was a 3-hour and 25-minute drive. So if he's leaving at 10:30, he would get there at about 2 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's when the alarm was deactivated at 2:14. A second toll booth worker, 230 miles away, and this worker was at the booth for the exit for Albany, which is only 9 miles from the Porco family home. She recalled seeing a yellow Jeep with a man in his early 20s, dark hair, resembling Chris, driving it. And he drove through the toll at 2 a.m. The Jeep stood out to her because of the excessive speed it was going. It was going way too fast. But it wasn't just the use of the master code and the weak alibi that led police to conclude that Chris had axed his mom and his dad. Digging deeper into his background, they found a pattern of antisocial behavior. Chris had been lying to his friends and his family for years, and these lies were finally catching up to him. And when I tell you the reason why Chris killed his parents, you're going to be really surprised. But I'm going to explain what led up to it. In the fall of 2002, Chris was a freshman at the University of Rochester, but he barely went to school, unless you consider drinking vodka and tequila and beer going to school. He never went to class. He ended up with a GPA of 0.0.
Stop it, really?
You could write your name on an exam and get higher than 0.0. Like, he didn't do shit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's such an asshole that he applied for retroactive medical inactive status, which means he was trying to say there was a medical reason he didn't attend school. He told the university that his poor attendance and his poor grades was a result of mono, which was a fucking lie.
For 4 months?
Yes. You can have mono for a long time, but he never provided any documentation to verify this. He didn't do much better the next two semesters, and he even failed to show up for his final exams. He didn't even take some of them. As a result, he ended up getting kicked out of the University of Rochester in 2003 with a GPA of 1.1. So he got it up.
He improved it.
He improved. See, look, Mom, I'm doing so much better now.
Right.
Chris loved his college life. It meant everything to him.
Sounded like it.
Oh, wait. Yes. He had a girlfriend there, and he was part of the Sigma Phi Epsilon fraternity. And he had developed the persona of a rich kid based on countless fabrications from him. He told everyone there that he had a wealthy and influential family, and he lived in the Outer Banks. He himself had million-dollar investments, and he often bragged about his family's lavish vacation homes. Being that the truth was 230 miles away, none of his friends or acquaintances knew any better. The university, surprise, surprise, ended up kicking Chris out. And in order for him to get back in, he would have to do well at a community college for a whole nother year and then apply. Chris was left with no choice but to go to the Hudson Valley Community College and move back in to his parents' home. And this is not anything he wanted. He moved back home and he started working part-time again at this place called the Bethany Veterinary Hospital, where he'd worked on and off for years. If you thought Chris did any better at Huron Valley Community College, you're wrong.
Are you shitting me?
Because he failed again.
What?
When Joan and Peter received his transcript in the mail, they were beyond disappointed. They told Chris they were done financing his education. He's such an ass. He tried to lie his way out of it by assuring his parents it was a mistake.
Of course.
And he actually excelled, and the school would be updating his transcript soon. And Chris's transcripts did get updated. You know who updated them? Chris.
Did he wipe the shit out or what?
He created fraudulent transcripts with excellent grades. And he submitted it to the University of Rochester and reapplied. And they let him in.
Stop it.
They did. I told you, he was going to go back to Rochester no matter what he had to do to make it happen.
Unless that meant going to class.
Yes, well, that meant. Besides that. So now he had to explain to his parents how he got into the University of Rochester, even though his last transcript from Huron Valley showed 00 or whatever the hell. I guess he didn't want to give him the fraudulent one. I don't know. But he ended up making up this really ridiculous lie about the University of Rochester. And this is how you see his antisocial personality just flourish. He's one of those guys that just lies about everything. And these are grandiose lies. He tells his parents that two professors who had said he got a 0 on his finals at the University of Rochester. Remember how he really didn't take the exams?
Mm-hmm.
He said, miraculously, both those professors found the missing exams. He had taken them.
It's a miracle.
And he had passed. And the University of Rochester was so embarrassed and so upset by this that they offered him tuition for free.
Shut up.
So he was allowed back in and they were going to pay for everything.
Really?
Yeah. He had to explain somehow to his parents how he was going to pay for school. But now the big problem is,
how's he going to pay for school?
Yes, that's exactly it. But he figured that one out too. He took out a $31,000 loan from Citibank by forging his father's signature.
Oh my God.
That's pretty ballsy.
Yes.
He used some of that money to buy himself a brand new, bright, yellow, shiny Jeep. Imagine Peter's surprise when, on November 3rd, 12 days before the murder, he received a notice in the mail saying he failed to make a payment for the loan he had. Which he didn't even know existed.
I'd be so pissed.
He was furious. Both Peter and Joan tried to call Chris, but he wouldn't answer their phone calls. Son of a bitch.
I can't blame him.
He would only talk to them via email.
That's ridiculous.
And of course, he tried to explain that he didn't do that. He didn't forge the signature or some shit like that. And his dad was like, I'm paraphrasing. He was like, shut up. I know you did. Chris was cut off from using his parents' credit cards. And warned if he did anything like that again, they'd call the police. In one email, Peter wrote to him, and this is a quote, "We may be disappointed with you, but your mother and I still love you, and we care about your future."
Aww.
Given a second chance at the University of Rochester, you'd think that Chris might go to class. But nah.
Why bother?
He continued partying excessively. He knew he was going to fail. He asked two of his friends if they would take his economics test for him, but they refused.
Ooh, economics is tough.
He knew he was going to fail out of the University of Rochester unless he could find a way for them to forgive his inevitable bad grades. If something were to happen to Chris's immediate family, say his parents were brutally slaughtered, the University of Rochester might give him another chance. Plus, Chris would stand to inherit half of Joan and Peter's $1 million life insurance policy. Chris had already used death as a means to get out of his obligations before, and it worked really well. Something I didn't tell you about Chris. For roughly 2 years, he'd been selling stolen computers and other electronics on eBay. Then he got even more greedy. And he began selling merchandise he didn't even possess. When one person complained that they paid thousands for a computer that they never got, Chris responded to the complaint by stating his name was David Porco, the fictitious brother of Chris, and that Chris had died.
Stop it.
In a car accident.
So he was a shady seller on eBay?
Yes.
And sold shit that didn't exist.
Yep. About 2 weeks before the murder, eBay froze his account and they'd caught on to him. Now, as police searched Chris's eBay records, they came upon a very surprising discovery that really pretty much put the nails in the coffin for Chris. Remember those three laptops that had been stolen from Peter and Joan in those two home invasions? Guess who sold them on eBay weeks after the burglary?
Unbelievable.
In addition, where Chris worked, the Bethlehem Veterinary Hospital, they also had a break-in while Chris worked there.
What a fucking coincidence.
In June of 2003. And like what happened at the Delmar house, someone had caught the screen to the first floor window and then broke the window. The same person disarmed the alarm system, stole the camcorder, pocket PCs, and a cell phone, then reactivated the alarm. 21 days later, Chris's eBay account shows that he sold all of the items stolen to people across the United States.
He's a fucking idiot.
Some other damning evidence to add to it, in case you think there's any doubt. A neighbor of the Porcos who'd left for work around 4 a.m. spotted a yellow Jeep in the family's driveway on the morning of the murders. And co-workers at the vet hospital testified that Chris owned scrubs. He had access to those booties and to rubber gloves, and he was often tasked with cleaning up after surgery. Thus, he knew how to avoid getting blood on himself. During the trial, Joan and Peter's other son, Jonathan, testified that the wooden axe with the red cheek used to murder his father strongly resembled the axe they kept in their garage, which was no longer in their garage. Chris's trial commenced in the summer of 2006. In the 2 years that had passed, he continued living with his mother, who supported his claims of innocence. The two often walked into court with their arms linked together to demonstrate their solidarity. On August 10th, in 2006, it took the jury less than 8 hours to find Chris guilty of the second-degree murder of his father, Peter Porco, and the attempted murder of his mother, Joan.
It was second degree?
Isn't that crazy? Mm-hmm. Second degree. I mean, it seems pretty premeditated right. to me, but.
I mean, he had to drive 230 miles.
I know. What was he going to do in the middle of the night?
Right.
Say hi?
Mm-hmm.
You know the crime, so let's talk about the consequence. On December 12th in 2006, Judge Jeffrey Berry sentenced Christopher Porco to a minimum of 50 years in prison, saying, quote, I fear very much what happened in the early morning hours of November 15th is something that could happen again. I think he means...
Joan.
Yeah. So that's the story of Peter Porco and Joan. I feel really bad for Joan, and I feel really bad for Jonathan.
Absolutely.
I have no idea how he feels, but if I was him, I would be a little torn.
A little?
At the minimum.
I'd be like, damn, look at all the evidence.
Damn, bro.
I mean, you don't want to believe it.
But I feel like he could be a little more objective than his mom.
Probably. So he tried to kill both his parents so he could continue going to college.
Yes. That's what I got out of it. And he was broke. He was flat broke. There's a bunch more about the money I didn't go into, but he ended up having to pay off the Jeep. He had credit card debt. He owed eBay.
Damn. For money.
And he was from a wealthy family, remember? He had to keep up.
Mm-hmm. That's really sad.
So that is our episode for the week. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you haven't done so already, just please hit that subscribe/follow button. Before we go, it is imperative that we do some shout-outs.
Oh, we haven't done them in a while.
I know. I know. We absolutely have to do it. And for those that don't know, these shout-outs are for people that have subscribed on our Apple channel or on our Patreon page, patreon.com/TNTCrimes or Crimes and Consequences X on Apple. We have a whole bunch of Halloween episodes for our exclusive members only.
Yes, we do.
And we've got the Toy Box Killer in the pipeline.
Oh! I don't even want to listen to Toy Box Killer again.
It's so bad. Oh. Anyway, these shout-outs are really important to us, and we want to thank each and every one of our brand new subscribers, so here we go. And I'm sure I'm going to slaughter some of your names. You ready?
I am ready.
Baby Snoozin'.
Baby Snoozin'. I love it.
Alexandria, Shelby, Anthony, Dolly, Chant, Ferez, Catton 2000, Haley F., Lisa E., Jonathan Y., Melissa R., Nailed by Meek 44. Who's Meek? Nicole, Chris R., Jose C., Candace bought us a drink.
Yay, Candace!
Julie R., David K., Carrie M., Miriam M., Cassie D., Robert C., Diana M., Chanel B., Karina J., Jenny C., Ann V., Barbara M., Megan W., Cece Signorita.
I love that.
Marcella or Marcella. One of the two. Or both.
One of the two. Or both.
Evron, Katie K., Erica G., Nate C., Kimberly W., Christy T., Dina S., Kate C. again. Different Kate C., Shayla H., Madison G., Natalie D., Jen C., Cheryl H., Chris with a K., Darian and Bonnie.
Yay!
Thank you guys so, so much.
You guys rock.
You can go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com, to learn more about how you can become a member. We have over 100 exclusive episodes, and we're going live this week.
You're probably going to hear this after we went live.
That's true. That's a valid point. Join us on our social media at Hardcore True Crime. And again, our website is crimesandconsequences.com. Anything else?
We have merch.
Oh, yeah, we have merchandise. Find it on our website. Some cool t-shirts. Christmas is coming.
Yes, Christmas is coming.
It's only a couple months away.
Get something for your hardcore true crime Crimes and Consequences fan.
What better way to say I love you? Simmer the Crimes and Consequences t-shirt.
Put it on your Christmas list.
Anything else?
That's everything, I believe.
Thank you guys all for listening. Thank you. Stay safe.
Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.